Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on trade secrets, facts that you're not supposed to know when we come back. And let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? It's pretty obvious that something is wrong, terribly wrong, with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools. The Ten Commandments have been banned from our public institutions and banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And now we're being taught the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our schools, in our public institutions, and we've now made them a part of our national public policy. And this is a radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but your daughter can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. That's not separation of church and state, boys and girls. And there's at least one school left in America that still teaches this entire Mosaic Law, that is the Ten Commandments and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty. And you don't have to know what that penalty is to suffer from its effect. So whether you call that the Mosaic Law, or the Law of God, or the Common Law, or Natural Law, or Karma, or something else, it's automatic. And it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on law, the law in general. And it's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. And best of all, it's free. You can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. All right, this week we have been talking about trade secrets. You know, things that if you knew would benefit you, it would level the playing field for you. If you knew the price that the dealer at the automobile agency paid for that car when he bought it from the Ford Motor Company, and you happen to have that secret, trade secret right there. I mentioned that to you earlier. Last time, I brought a druggist in here. A druggist sitting right here in the studio. And I said, hey, Tom. Tom, that wasn't his real name, but I wanted to interview a druggist, and I happen to have doctors and dentists and chiropractors and druggists, you know, who are students here at the school from time to time. And this fellow happens to be a druggist, and we're on trade secrets. And I thought, well, gee, what are some of the trade secrets of the pharmaceutical industry? And so for 2 hours and two sessions here, he sat here and he just spilled his guts and told us about how the drugs are poison. And then I asked him the question. I said, now, Tom, do you use these drugs yourself? I mean, you're selling them out here to the general public. Do you use them? So, oh, my God, no, I wouldn't use those drugs. They're poison. He said they're not effective, number one. And number two, they're dangerous. And number three, they cost more than you can buy them for down on the street corner. You remember that? Now, the drugstore, that is Rexall and Noxco, Buttery, and all the places, the outlets where you go to buy these drugs, have cocaine, heroin, and marijuana for sale. They don't sell heroin under the name heroin. They sell it under oxycodone, I think he said, and some other trade names. You can buy it in pill form, you can buy it in liquid form, or you can inject it. Isn't that just special? But he said it costs about four times more. And so I asked him before he came into the studio, I said, would you check with anybody that you know out there on the street as to what marijuana costs and cocaine and heroin? He found the price of marijuana. He said marijuana costs about $100 a month for the average user to use. And if you buy it at the drugstore from him, it costs four times that, $400 a month. And he said he thought probably cocaine and heroin were probably about the same. Whatever you're spending now for heroin on the street, you can buy it at the drugstore for about four times more. Now, that tells us why it is that there's a war on drugs. There's a war on drugs because it's a free market enterprise, and we want a monopoly, and the pharmaceutical industry has that monopoly. Now, remember, he said that these drugs are dangerous. Dangerous. Well, listen to this. Does mercury in vaccines cause autism in children? A definitive answer has proven elusive, and it remains so to this day. No one can say with certainty that thimerosal, the vaccine preservative that is made with 49.6% mercury, helped fuel an explosion in reported cases of autism, attention deficit disorder, speech delay, and other disorders over the past decade. But no one can say for certain that it did not, either. Now, in the prologue to this story, Lynn Ridwood got the call from a lawyer friend only an hour before the vote. The prospects were bad, he told her. It was too late to do much about it now. The news came like a kick in the gut, and Lynn almost dropped the phone into a pot of pasta on the stove. Damn, she shouted. Her cry was loud enough to startle her 8-year-old child, her son, Will, who sat quietly at the kitchen table in the Redwoods' expansive house south of Atlanta, Georgia. The boy nearly burst into tears. It was the evening of November the 13th, 2002, and the House of Representatives was about to approve the historic Homeland Security Act. Lynn was all for security in the age of Al-Qaeda, but she never dreamed that it would come with such a price tag. The lawyer told Lynn that some unnamed agent had secretly inserted a last-minute provision into the bill, adding two brief paragraphs onto the massive document before the roll call vote. The provision would dismiss hundreds of civil lawsuits filed by parents against Eli Lilly and other drug manufacturing companies for allegedly allowing dangerous levels of mercury into their children's vaccines. Very few members of Congress knew that this important writer was in the Homeland Security bill. This stealth writer would change everything, wiping out years of struggle that Lynn and many others had endured to get their day in court. Will Redwood had autism, the 8-year-old child, and Lynn blamed it on the mercury in his vaccine shots. The toxic heavy metal was used as a vaccine preservative called thimerosal. Thimerosal had been developed by Eli Lilly and Company back in the 1920s, though Eli Lilly no longer made the product, but the company still licensed the product to other producers and reportedly earned a profit in the bargain. Now, Lynn and her husband, Tommy, had filed a thimerosal lawsuit in Georgia State Civil Court. The Redwoods and other parents had spent 3 years compiling evidence of mercury poisoning in their children. Many were preparing to present this evidence in individual and class action lawsuits filed in courts of law all across the United States. But now, with the stroke of a computer keyboard, all of those lawsuits would now be thrown out. The Redwoods and hundreds of others would be left in the legal lurch without due process or any further recourse. Now there would be no day in court. This surreptitious writer essentially funneled all thimerosal lawsuits into a little-known federal claims court that had been created by Congress in 1986 to compensate people for the damages caused by vaccine injuries or death. The vaccine court, as it is known, shields drug makers from liability by having awards paid out of a taxpayer-funded account rather than by companies themselves through lawsuits. But there was one hitch. The vaccine court had a statute of limitations of 3 years. And if your child had allegedly demonstrated signs of injury before that period, as was the case with Will Redwood, the tens of thousands of other autistic children like him, you were just plain out of luck. You could not enter the federal compensation program. And for this reason, the Redwoods had brought their claim in civil court in Georgia. Here, the burden of proof was higher, but so were the potential payouts. Parents of autistic children were facing lifelong bills estimated at more than $2 million per child, and the families were neither greedy nor litigious, as some politicians had charged. They were desperate. And now, the only door left open, civil court, was being slammed shut in their faces, perversely, by an anti-terrorism bill. An anti-terrorism bill which had absolutely nothing to do with autism. The irony was punishing. Congress was approving a colossal reorganization of the bureaucracy to fortify the nation in the perilous post-9/11 world. It was all being done in the name of liberty, as President Bush had said. But what liberty was there, Lynn thought, when greedy hands in the pharmaceutical industry blithely rewrote laws and then slapped justice in the face? The language in the writer dismissing the lawsuits was nothing new. It had been drafted the year before, written as part of a larger vaccine injury bill, which was crafted by a senator from Tennessee. The senator from Tennessee is named Bill Frist. He's the majority leader in the Republican Senate. He's a conservative Republican with strong ties to the drug industry, and he's the only medical doctor to serve in the upper chamber. Lynn Redwood and many other parents had fought ferociously all summer against the Frist vaccine bill. Their Democratic allies, who controlled the Senate at the time, had prevailed, and it was one more battle in the ongoing thimerosal war. But at least the parents had won this round, or so they thought. But Republicans had just swept the midterm elections on November the 5th, 2002, and they recaptured control of the Senate. Now, someone in the Republican Party, it is safe to assume, was feeling pretty cocky and confident enough to pull this off, but they hadn't reckoned with the wave of outrage that they were about to unleash. Lynn Redwood ran to the computer in her large, comfortable home and fired off an urgent communique to several comrades across the country, good friends like Liz Burt, an attorney from Chicago with an autistic son, Matthew, and Sally Bernard, a successful marketing executive out in Aspen, Colorado, with an afflicted boy of her own named Bill. For 3 years, since the government had admitted that most American kids vaccinated between 1990 and 2000 were exposed to mercury levels in excess of federal safety limits, Lynn, Liz, and Sally had been drawn to each other in a common cause. They grew united in the belief that thimerosal had damaged their children and hurled them into the shattered hell of autism. They had formed an influential advocacy and research group called the Coalition for Safe Minds. largely self-taught in the complexities of biochemistry, toxicology, and epidemiology, the three mothers and dozens of their allies had taken on science, business, and government with their radical new mercury autism hypothesis. Many parents of autistic children applauded the women and bestowed on them an affectionate nickname. They were called the Mercury Moms. But on the other side of the equation, within the inner circles of their powerful opponents, the women had earned themselves ridicule and scorn. "Well, it looks like they caught us unaware," Lynn wrote to Liz and Sally and a handful of other parents that evening. "I just received a phone call that parts of the Frist bill dealing with thimerosal are being added to the Homeland Security bill that is being voted on tonight. Please, if possible, try to contact your local representative by email and ask that they specifically exclude anything related to the vaccine compensation bill being included in Homeland Security." Everyone who got the message tried desperately to do something to alert lawmakers, but it was too late. Even some of the parents' staunchest allies were about to vote away their rights, however unwittingly, in the name of freedom. One of the people most devastated by the news was Laura Bono, the mother of a 12-year-old boy, Jackson, who had been diagnosed not only with severe autism, but also with mercury poisoning. And Laura and her husband, Scott, who was an insurance salesman in Durham, North Carolina, were about to file a civil lawsuit of their own. It had been several years since Jackson's diagnosis, and they were ineligible to file in vaccine court. Jackson's medical and educational care had already cost over $700,000, and much of it was not covered by insurance. The Bonos had depleted their savings simply struggling to provide for their very sick son. Scott and Laura Bono had fought side by side with other parents against the Frist bill and were ardent believers in the mercury autism connection. And the Bonos had connections in Washington. Scott had shown since high school a bright conservative young woman named Beth Clay in recent years, and Beth had gone to work on the Republican staff of the House Committee on Government Reform. By chance, the committee's colorful chairman was the controversial Republican Congressman Dan Burton of Indiana, a man with his own suspicions about thimerosal. Burton, as it turned out, has a grandson named Christian, who had become desperately ill after receiving his multiple vaccinations against several childhood diseases, which were given to him in one day. Most of them contained thimerosal, and within days, Christian became completely unaware of his surroundings. He would run aimlessly around the house, screaming indiscriminately, flapping his arms and banging his head against the walls. Doctors diagnosed him with acute autism. Dan Burton blamed thimerosal. When Laura Bono got Lynn Redwood's email, she called Beth Clay on her cell phone. "Beth, they've stuck a rider in to protect Lily from lawsuits," Laura said. "You have to alert Burton." So Beth leapt into action. She knew that the congressman, had he known about the Lily rider, would have gone ballistic and scrambled to the House floor to raise hellfire among his colleagues. But Beth was unable to reach Burton before he cast his lot to protect the homeland. The next day, Dan Burton was fuming. There was only one person in Washington, he thought, who wielded the power and had the gall to commit such an act. And that was Republican leader, Majority Leader, Richard Armey, who was set to resign at the end of the year. Burton and a few staffers marched over to Armey's office and confronted the politically powerful Texan with a slow, folksy drawl. And I'm told the two of them almost got into a fistfight. Beth told Scott Bono later that day, "I have never seen the chairman so angry in my life. And believe me, I have seen him pretty damned steamed before, but nothing like this. If only I had gotten to him, maybe we could have stopped this." But what did he say? Scott asked anxiously. Army, I mean, what did he say about the Lily Rider? Well, Dick Army did it, Beth said. He said the request came from the White House. It came from George Bush. It sounds that, and it would be weeks before Dick Army would admit and then deny the legislative mischief that he had created. In the meantime, the mystery over who had inserted this controversial provision, three other unrelated writers were also clandestinely stapled to the bill, had become, as the New York Times put it, a Washington whodunit worthy of Agatha Christie. On Capitol Hill, congressional aides turned detectives have traced the emergence of the provision to the Veterans Day weekend, wrote the Times' Cheryl Gay Stolberg, flush from their party's victories on Election Day and with a mandate from President Bush to pass a domestic security bill. Republican negotiators in the House and Senate hold up for 3 days in the Capitol to hammer out the details on this rider. One aide told the paper that the language mysteriously appeared in the House version of the bill in entirely different type than the rest of the measure, as though someone had clipped it out of Mr. Frist's legislation and simply pasted it in. All of the negotiators apparently supported the move, but no one would say who was responsible for putting it in. Critics of the provision, the Times noted, were quick to point out that the White House has close ties to the Eli Lilly pharmaceutical company. The first President Bush sat on the Lilly board in the late 1970s. And the White House budget director, Michael E. Daniels Jr., is a former Eli Lilly executive. The company's chairman and chief executive, Sidney Taurel, was appointed in June by President Bush to serve on a presidential council that will advise Mr. Bush on domestic security. The White House denied having any hand in the rider, and so did Eli Lilly. I personally had no involvement whatsoever with these provisions, Mitch Daniels protested. I spoke to no one, either inside the administration or outside of the administration. I did not have any communication with anyone from Eli Lilly regarding the issue, and indeed I had not even heard of thimerosal until now, he said. Which is not surprising, because Eli Lilly stopped making thimerosal a decade before I began working there. To many observers, that seemed very surprising, and what was surprising was that Daniels, who had been Lilly's senior vice president for corporate strategy, had not known about a product that was licensed by his own company. Lilly executives also feigned ignorance. We made absolutely no contact with Mitch or anyone in his office about this, company spokesman Rob Smith said at the time. It's a mystery to us as to how it got in there. Now, on November the 18th, Dan Burton went to the House floor and he demanded that the rider be removed before the Senate voted on the act. These provisions don't belong in this bill, he said. This is not a homeland security issue. This is a fairness issue. This is a legal issue. We have an epidemic on our hands. It's called autism. And Burton warned in a statement released the same day, more and more parents believe that the autism affecting their children is related to a mercury preservative used in numerous vaccines given to their children. These provisions in the Homeland Security Bill will cut off their recourse to the courts, and that's just plain wrong. Instead of passing legislation to take away the rights of families with vaccine-injured children, we should be passing legislation to try to help these people. Senate Democrats agreed and offered a motion to kill the Lilly rider before voting on the legislation. The move was opposed by none other than Senator Bill Frist, the majority leader, the Republican majority leader in the Senate. We are a nation at risk, Frisk intoned gravely in the Senate. The threat of liability should not become a barrier to the protection of the American people. The implication was that thimerosal liability protection was essential if companies were going to develop vaccines against bioterrorism weapons like smallpox and anthrax. but Frist failed to mention that these vaccines contain no thimerosal whatsoever. Now, Lynn Redwood's phone was ringing off the hook. Good Morning America wanted to talk to her, and so did Bob Herbert, columnist for the New York Times. Herbert went on the offensive against the Lilly writer. Buried in this massive bill, he wrote, snuck into it in the dark of the night by persons unknown, actually it's fair to say by Republican persons unknown, was a provision that, incredibly, will protect Eli Lilly and all of the other big pharmaceutical companies from lawsuits by parents who believe their children have been harmed by this thimerosal. And there's a real bad smell here. Eli Lilly will benefit greatly as both class action and individual lawsuits were derailed. But there are no fingerprints in sight. No one will own up to the legislative deed that is both cynical and shameful. The politicians with their hands out and the fat cats with plenty of money to spread around have carried the day. Nothing is too serious to exploit, not even the defense of the homeland during a time of terror. And as for Lynn Redwood and the Safe Minds Advocacy Group, Herbert wrote, they are at a slight disadvantage wielding a pop gun against the nuclear-powered influence of an Eli Lilly. The effort to kill the writer failed despite intense lobbying by parents and their allies on Capitol Hill. The next day, the Senate passed the House version of the bill in its entirety. The same day, the Bush administration lawyers quietly filed a motion in the federal vaccine court to permanently seal the records on all thimerosal-related material handed over by the government. But the furtive move was also a blessing in disguise, Lynn thought. So many people had dismissed the mercury autism theory as pure nonsense. Despite all of their efforts to connect the scientific dots between thimerosal and neurological disorders, the parents had been unable to gain much attention, let alone support. But now, all of that was changing. If government and industry had teamed up together, and if they had nothing to fear from thimerosal lawsuits because, scientifically, it could be shown that thimerosal was not the culprit, many observers began asking, what was the need, then, for all of this secret maneuvering in the Congress and by the White House and the rush to liability protection for the pharmaceutical industry? Well, boys and girls, President Bush just did the same thing recently, just a few days ago, in this new legislation that's being called the Torture Bill to protect against the past torture activities ordered by the White House. Now Congress has passed a new bill to protect them. That's what we call in law an ex post facto law. After the fact has occurred, then we pass a law to protect them. This is an ex post facto law also. But boys and girls, Congress has the power to do it. And they did it. Now, there's an election coming up, and many of you are sitting there saying, well, by God, I'll vote for the Democrats next time. Well, before you vote for the Democrats, let's take a look at another story after we take our break. This story is the prologue from a new book called Evidence of Harm, written by David Kirby. Evidence of Harm, David Kirby, Mercury and Vaccines and the Autism Epidemic. It's a medical controversy. Well, not long ago, California banned thimerosal. California. You know those fruits and nuts out there in the West. Banned thimerosal, and the incidence of autism has taken a nosedive. It's down by 50%. Now, what's that tell you? Now, I'm not a scientist, and I'm not a Bill Frist, and I'm not a politician, and I'm not a big-wig muckety-muck, but you know, my common sense tells me there's a connecting link, boys and girls. And this fellow, Dick Armey, snuck in the middle of the night and put the writer on the bill. That's very common. Hell, that goes on day in and day out. When the Democrats are in power, they put in those secret writers for their constituencies, and when the Republicans are in power, they put in those writers for their constituencies. Voting Republican and Democrat, boys and girls, is your problem, not your solution. You got Dianne Feinstein on the one hand trying to take your guns away from you, and then you have Dick Armey and the Republicans on the other side over here taking away your right to sue when you've been damaged. And you're going to go to the polls and vote Republican or Democrat and call these people your friends? Well, boys and girls, with friends like that in Congress, you don't need any enemies. Let me tell you. Remember the book, Evidence of Harm, Mercury and Vaccines and the Autism Epidemic. It's called A Medical Controversy, written by a fellow named David Kirby. A big, thick book. It's about 500 pages. And I haven't completed reading it, but I did read the introduction and the prologue. And when we come back, we're going to take a look at the healing oils of the Bible. You know, what would we use if we didn't use drugs? Is there anything else that we might use in place of drugs to heal ourselves when we are desperately ill? But let me give you a reminder first, and that is that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that number is 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. But they probably do. And for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Now, let me change course here a little bit. I gave you the bad news, and I said, now, listen to this autism story from the prologue of the book Evidence of Harm by David Kirby. Here's a second book. I'm going to review both of these books as time progresses along, but I wanted to use some excerpts out of them to demonstrate my point that there is a number of secret, trade secrets, secret little trade secrets that you don't know about. But if you did know about them, you could do something very constructive for yourself. The second book is called Healing Oils of the Bible by David Stewart. Just write that down, Healing Oils of the Bible by David Stewart. My wife has completed reading the book, recommended it very highly to me, and I'm in the process. And I got over to chapter 3, and it's called Atheistic Medicine and the Priesthood of Healing. Chapter 3, Atheistic Medicine. Now, what in the hell is atheistic medicine? Well, David Stewart has quite a story to tell here, and it fits in so well with this autism story that I just couldn't resist, especially after interviewing a pharmacist, a druggist, who said he wouldn't take, he wouldn't touch, he wouldn't use the very products that he makes and sells every day because they're poison and they're not effective. Well, is there an alternative that is not poison and that is effective? Well, in ancient cultures the world over, the healers of a society were also known as the priests. And with the advent of science a few centuries ago, men's faith in God began to be replaced by faith in science, in the belief that scientific method, or the scientific method, could provide the answers to all of life's questions. And with that came the development of secular or atheistic medicine, which is what professional health care in America has become today. Now, I'm not saying that all of the doctors and nurses are atheists. Many of them are not. I'm saying that the textbooks of medicine and the textbooks of nursing are totally devoid of any acknowledgement of God as the ultimate and sole source of healing. Prayer and God communion are not required disciplines in medical or nursing schools anywhere in the United States of America. So we have a false God in our time. It is now apparent that the secularization of the healing arts has been a major error, leading to countless deaths and the destruction of personal wellness. And while science has served us well in improving our standards of living and bringing us many advances, people have grown to expect more from science than science can ever possibly deliver. And it has become a false God. It has become the idol of modern civilization. It has become the scientific method, which cannot touch the most important aspects of our existence and will never have the answers for most of life's most important questions. It's called the priesthood of healing, and the worship of science is particularly manifest with modern medicine, in which people have come to place more faith in medicine than they have in God or of Christ. This includes most church-going Christians. The book Confessions of a Medical Heretic by physician Robert S. Mendelsohn, M.D., listed in the bibliography, describes how people have come to regard modern medicine with a faith traditionally reserved for religion. And according to Mendelsohn, doctors are regarded as priests, and hospitals are regarded as temples where medical miracles take place in response to the dispensing of holy waters that we call drugs, serums, and antibiotics, and the performance of rituals and sacrifices that we call surgery and radiation therapy. And furthermore, the public is coerced into tithing to this healthcare system through insurance and tax-supported government medical programs, where the amount of the tithe is not 10%, but it's 20, 30, or 40% of one's income, and in some cases, even more. Now, we read of the idols and the false gods in the Old Testament of the Bible, and then we smile because we see them for what they are. Idols, false gods. And then we wonder how such large numbers of intelligent people could have ever believed in these inanimate objects as having life and divinity. It's hard for us to conceive It's hard for us to believe how Old Testament idol worshippers could have placed their faith and their very lives on such a transparently false basis. But idols and false gods are just as abundant today in America as they ever were, and millions bet their lives on these false gods every day. And the principal idol that most people worship today is allopathic medicine, which appears legitimate, and it appears to be real, because it wears the mask of science. Now, according to Dr. Mendelsohn, today's system of health care is really a system of sick care. It isn't health care, it's sick care, health being totally outside the domain of medicine. The best of medicine is emergency medicine, says Mendelsohn. When there is a real crisis to deal with, emergency medicine steps in. As for chronic disease and the common flus and colds, which represent 95% of the conditions that real people suffer from, modern medicine has no cures. Modern medicine has no answers. Modern medicine only has treatments that never end. They're cash cows forever. Now, the hidden objective of today's medical profession is to generate as much repeat business as possible. They don't aim to cure you. Cured people don't come back. Cured people are not repeat business. Only the sick are cash cows. Only the sick create repeat business. A healthy population is bad business for the medical system. Now, I'm sure that if they were aware of cures, most physicians would prescribe these cures. But for most conditions, they have no cures within the confines of their allopathic education. They have treatments galore, but they have no cures. Essential oils, which can lead to complete healing, are not within their paradigm. In place of a cure, most doctors will just try to manage your sickness. If they follow the protocols and standards by which they're pledged to practice, which they have learned in medical school, they will eventually place you on a regimen of lifelong dependency and turn you into a lifelong source of income for themselves and the system they serve. Doctors are also good at taking a simple issue and then escalating that simple issue into an acute problem through their interventions. Doctors can transform a simple condition into a life-threatening crisis. They may not be able to correct minor ailments, but serious problems they can handle. This is their training. When I was in medical school, an obstetrics professor once told a class of medical students, where I was present and heard from his own lips, that to him normal labor was boring, but doing cesarean surgery was exciting. It makes your day, he said. As a result of such teachings and attitudes, 6 out of 7 cesarean deliveries today are totally unnecessary, and they do far more harm than good. Doctors love to practice heroic medicine. Dr. Mendelsohn likens them to firemen fighting to rescue the perishing by putting out fires that they themselves have started. In the process, people die. People die unnecessarily. Survivors rarely realize that the cause of their loved one's demise was the system from which they had sought help in the first place. Hippocrates, the father of physicians, required an oath of his students that started, "Primum no cursi," first do no harm. That oath is not taken by physicians any longer. It hasn't been a part of medicine for more than half a century. A God-based medical system would first do no harm, but the pharmacologically based system that we have today has control over the total healthcare system today, and it does great harm. The numbers of people who are killed and injured every year are staggering. It amounts to a passenger jet crash every day. According to the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention, called the CDCP, over the past decade, more than 2 million people were admitted to hospital emergency rooms each year suffering from adverse drug reactions from prescriptions or over-the-counter medications. Let me repeat that, children. This comes from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. This is a government agency in Atlanta, Georgia. And they admitted that 2 million people, got that number? 2 million people are admitted to our hospitals every year. Every year. Because of some drug problem. Drugs. Not illegal drugs, legal drugs. The legal drugs that our druggist, Bill Collins, told us about yesterday. More than 100,000 people die every year in the United States from properly administered prescription drugs. These are drugs that are administered by doctors and nurses in hospitals and nursing homes, and 100,000 people every year die. So out of the 2 million people, you got 100,000 people that die every year. At least another 100,000 die from improperly administered drugs and other medical mistakes. So you got 100,000 that die from properly administered drugs and 100,000 that die from improperly administered drugs. This is now from the Center for Disease in Atlanta, Georgia, the CDCP, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. This is what they admit to. These are the official numbers. These are lies. They're understated. It's double that, and maybe it's four times as many. Other sources that keep track of these numbers say that the CDC is understating the problem. But hell, kids, let's just take the official numbers. Let's just take the lies at face value and extrapolate them out and see what it leads to. Deaths caused by physicians are called iatrogenic, and deaths due to hospital-caused factors are called nosocomial. The CDCP has a whole division for the tabulation and study of iatrogenic and nosocomial deaths and diseases. That's spelled N-O-S-O-C-O-M-I-A-L. Nosocomial, I guess, is the way we pronounce that. Just being a farm boy out here, not being a doctor, no? Now, the July 2000 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association attributes 250,000 deaths a year to doctors and pharmaceuticals with prescription drugs as the third leading cause of death in the United States, and iatrogenia, doctor mistakes, as the eighth. Now, you can go to a website called www.mercola.com. Why don't you try that? www.mercola.com to get those statistics and figures. Now let's just run this one by you. The CDC says you got 100,000 killed by drugs that are properly administered. And then you got 100,000 killed by drugs that are improperly administered. And then you got the American Medical Association. They come out and they say there's 250,000 killed. I don't know what proportion of the original 200,000 are repeat business. See where our problem is? And they may overlap. So we'll just stick with the lower number, the 200,000. Is that fair enough? We won't take the higher numbers or the controversial numbers at the CDC. After all, the CDC is the official government statistics. And my God, children, if you can't believe your government, who can you believe? Going on, 250,000 iatrogenic fatalities per year is many times more than those who die from illegal drugs, and I've reported this before. The people who die of illegal drugs on the street corner, you know, Sam the drug dealer, the guy that's peddling crack, heroin, and marijuana, okay, they kill 6,000 a year. Illegal drugs in this country kill 6,000 drug addicts a year. Okay. But the physicians in the hospitals kill 200,000 a year. Let's just divide that out. I'm going to write in 200,000 in my famous Texas Instruments Sharp EL1197 G3 calculator and divide that by 6,000. That's 33.33. You're 33 times more likely to be killed by your doctor
than you are by a drug dealer down on the corner. And they talk about safe drugs, and they talk about clean drugs, and they talk about, my God, you wouldn't want to buy drugs from a drug dealer down on the corner? Why, they're not clean. They're not safe. They're not approved. But the safe, clean drugs kill 33 times more people every year. So if you're interested in numbers, tuck that one away in your heart. Yet, if a couple of dozen people die from street drugs in a month's time in a given area, that becomes national news. Yes, we have an illegal drug problem in America, but it pales when compared to the problem of legal medicine, which is legally administered. 250,000 iatrogenic deaths a year comes down to 5,000 deaths a week. That's equivalent to a jumbo jet crashing every day, killing everybody on board. Got that, boys and girls? Now, remember, we had an airplane crash here a few years ago. I think it was 1996. It was called TWA-800. Books have been written. The government spent $100 million fishing all the pieces out of the ocean and bringing them in. They built a big hangar, and they assembled the jet, and they wrote up a big report, you know, like the 9/11 report, and spent millions of dollars doing it. Remember that? Killed less than 500 people. There was 262 people, as I recall, killed in that plane crash. Spent $100 million. Excuse me. Let's place $100 million into our famous Texas Instruments EL1197G3 computer, and let's divide that by 262 people. And we spent $381,679 per passenger to find out why that jet crashed. That's a lot of money. $381,000 per person on that airplane to find out why it crashed. Boys and girls, 5,000 people a week die from doctors and hospitals and legal drugs. 5,000 people a week. How many jets is that? Well, let's see. Let's take our famous 5,000 and let's divide that by 500. That's 10. The maximum number of people that you can crowd into one of those 747s is 500 people. The Japanese have a version of that. My God, that would be 10 jumbo jets. That's 10. That's 2 747s crashing with 500 people in them every day, 365 days a year. You got that, kids? And you get real excited about spinach killing one person, and they're talking about a national bureaucracy to monitor spinach, for crying out loud. Over 200 people getting sick and one of them dying, and we're going to have this bureaucracy created. Hell, you got 250,000 people a year being killed, 200,000 of them officially designated by the CDC being killed every year. By your doctors, for crying out loud. I mean Joe Sixpack doctor down on the corner in your local hospital. Now, even one such crash is cause for national mourning. Such tragedies spawn news stories for weeks to follow and prompt immediate and thorough investigations. But nothing is ever said in the news about an even worse tragedy happening every week, month after month, year after year, for decades. Even through the U.S. Center for Disease Control routinely tabulate and publish all of this data. I mean, they're putting this out every week. This is official government numbers. Lies, though they may be, they're the official government numbers. And the government says, hey, we're killing 5,000 people a week down here in the local hospital and over here in Sam Walton's pharmacy here at Walmart. Hey, you get more excitement out of E. coli and one person dying over spinach than you do out of 5,000 people dying every week from iatrogenic disease. Now, don't you? I don't know. It sounds like insanity to me. It just sounds like stupidity and nonsense. I'm not concerned about spinach. I'm not excited about E. coli. I don't give a rat's ass about E. coli and spinach. I'm real concerned about my doctor shooting me up with something that's going to kill me. That's why I stay away from doctors and hospitals. unless I was unconscious, taken to the hospital, totally out of it, didn't know where in the hell I was. Let me assure you that the minute I wake up and I look around the room and I see all of those white-gowned people standing around me, if there's any strength left in my body, I will get up and get the hell out of there as rapidly as possible. Hell, I'll run out of there stark, raving, buck-ass naked, if that's what it takes. Well, that's what I think of. That's just my personal view. Now, how many people die from herbs and oils? Well, Dr. Kurt Sunderbilt, Ph.D., in his book Advanced Aromatherapy, states that the American Association of Poison Control Centers reported 809 fatal poisonings and 6,407 serious but non-fatal poisonings from conventional pharmaceuticals between 1988 and 1989, whereas plant-based preparations caused 2 fatalities and 53 serious poisonings in the same time period. All right. Now, your chances of being poisoned... You know, poison? Okay. That's the bottle with the skull and crossbones. Between essential oils in a 10-year period, it's 2 people versus 809. Let me just tuck that one away. 809 divided by 2 is what? Okay. Your chances of being fatally poisoned by some pharmaceutical agent is 400 times greater than being poisoned by a natural oil or a natural herb. Now, you know, those are odds. I think if you were standing at a crap table and the odds were 400 to 1, I mean, you know, your chances of winning the lottery are 84 million to 1. Your chances of being poisoned by a pharmaceutical agent is 400 times greater than being poisoned by an aromatic herb or an aromatic oil or an herb. I think I'll try the herbs and the aromatic oils. Now, that's just my personal opinion, but let's try it. The most dangerous plants were not medicinal. They were houseplants and shrubs. And in the same time frame, there were no serious or fatal poisonings from essential oils. Essential oils. Now, the essential oils, there's 32 of them mentioned in the Bible. There are more than 100 essential oils, but 32 essential oils are mentioned in the Bible. And these 32 essential oils are medicines. Medicines that were designed by God to cure your diseases. You know, when you get something wrong with you, you need something to fix it. And the guy that wrote the neat book here is called, his name is David Stewart, and it's called Healing Oils of the Bible. And I'll do a review of Healing Oils of the Bible and carry it through one step further and show you that it's not only not dangerous, but it's efficient. And it works. It actually cures. Healing oils will cure your diseases. Drugs will not. We'll do that at some time in the future. Hey, I'm about out of time. Remember the 2 books that I just mentioned to you? Evidence of Harm by David Kirby and Healing Oils of the Bible by David Stewart. Get a copy of them and read them up. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about The Law School or The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. Hey, I'm about out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. So I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.